All right, we've been discussing the various chapters in Daniel of the predictive sections. Before we started on 9, I had discussed 2 and 7. Remember, there's that close similarity between 2 and 7. And I thought just before going further, it might be helpful to review that in this way. In 2, you have the head of gold, the breast and arms, silver, and belly and thighs of bronze, legs and feet of iron. Compared with the lion, the bear, the leopard, the beast, dreadful and terrible, paralleling in each chapter the Babylonian, Medo-Persian, Greek, and Roman Empire, with Orthodox interpreters, whether there's First Advent view or Second Advent view, the succession of kingdoms is the same. It's different from the critical approach, which goes Babylonian, Median, Persian, Greek. But you see, the point of difference comes down here at the bottom. The question is, with this Roman Empire, is there a gap here in phases of this last period in each chapter? That is, in chapter 2, between the legs and the feet, or in chapter 7, between the beast and the 10 horns and the little horn. You see, there's a gap posited, where this green arrow goes, at that point by the Second Advent interpreters, or at least with chapter 2, you would say there's a gap there with the Second Advent interpreters. And what you have is a revival of the Roman Empire and appearance of Antichrist after a gap of some unspecified period of time. Now, with Daniel 7, someone like Jung sees it continuous because he sees a three-phase saying of the beast, the 10 horns, and the little horn just moving on continuously throughout history until the time of the Antichrist, whereas other Second Advent interpreters of chapter 7 would posit a gap here between the beast and the 10 horns. And the 10 horns are the time of the revival of the Roman Empire, the period of the Antichrist. So you get that distinction in chapter 7 between those who see the whole thing as continuous, climaxing with Second Advent and Antichrist, or those that see a similar gap between 7 and 2, and therefore see a parallel between the 10 horns and the, notice 10 question mark, doesn't say 10 toes, just says that, just makes a reference to the toes in verse 42 of chapter 2. 42 says, "And as the toes of the feet were part iron, part of clay, the kingdom shall be part of stone, part of gold." Okay, any question then on the relation of 2 and 7? If not, let's go on to number 5 on your outline, which is Daniel chapter 11. I won't take the time to go through chapter 11 verse by verse. It's a long chapter, and it's very detailed in its description of future history, which quite clearly in a large segment of the chapter is future history of the intertestament period, relationships between the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. But I think there are a few general points that we might look at, and let me get at them by asking 2 questions. First question is, what do verses 2 to 20 talk about in chapter 11? What do verses 2 to 20 talk about? Who are the kings and queens referred to? See, if you glance down through that, for example, Verse 3, a mighty king shall stand up. Verse 5, the king of the south shall be strong. And verse 6, the king's daughter of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement. And verse 7, the king of the north shall deal against them. Verse 9, the king of the south shall come into his kingdom. Verse 11, the king of the south shall be moved with anger. Verse 13, the king of the north shall return. It goes back and forth like that. King of the north, king of the south, with various details given about relationships between them. Who are the kings referred to? What are the specific things in view that the king of the north did and the king of the south did? How do the details of this section, down to verse 20, fit with history? Now, if you look at almost any commentary, you can find rather detailed explanations of exactly what is in view in the statements of the chapter. And I would say if you compare critical commentaries and evangelical commentaries, you'll find general agreement. There's not a lot of dispute about what's in view here. But the second question is, I'll come back to the first question in a minute. Second question is, who is talked about in verse 21 and following? Who is talked about in verse 21 and following? And do interpreters agree or differ on the interpretation of verses 21 through the end of the chapter? If the reference is to Antiochus Epiphanes, you see, you read in verse 21, and in his estate shall stand up a vile person, to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably, shall obtain the kingdom by flatteries. Who's in view there? Is that Antiochus Epiphanes? And does the rest of the chapter speak about Antiochus Epiphanes? Can you fit the details of the statements in the rest of the chapter to what we know of the life of Antiochus Epiphanes? Or do some things fit and some not fit? Now, those are two questions then. What about verses 2 to 20? What about verses 21 through the end of the chapter? What is in view? If you had time to research that, I think you would find that there's general agreement that in the first section you have a rather detailed picture of the course of history from Persian time till the rise of Antiochus. 2 to 20. A rather detailed picture of the course of history from Persian times till the rise of Antiochus. You notice verse 2. There shall stand up three kings in Persia. The fourth shall be far richer than they. So you're talking in verse 2 about the Persian period. When you go on to 3 and 4, a mighty king shall stand up that shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will, and when he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken and shall be divided toward the four winds of heaven, and not to his posterity, nor according to his dominion, which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be plucked up even for others besides those. I should have read the last phrase of verse 2, where it says, he shall stir up all against the realm of Greece, and a mighty king shall stand up that shall rule with great dominion. 3 and 4 seems to give a very brief summary description of the rise of Alexander and the ultimate division of his kingdom into four parts. So 3 and 4, that Greek period, and then verses 5 through 20, wars between the kings of the south, who are the Ptolemies, and the kings of the north, who are the Seleucids, where they struggle for dominion over Palestine, the Holy Land. And it's an interesting section because it is so detailed. You know, we said earlier in this course, first quarter, that prophecy generally does not give as complete a description as historical writing does. A lot of the details are left out. This is a passage that would be, I would say, an exception to that, because you have a very detailed picture of this period of history. But most interpreters, whether evangelical or non-evangelical, would agree on, for the most part, the interpretation of the statements of these verses. So I'll refer you, just if you're interested in those details, to most any commentary. Second question is more complex. Who is talked about in verse 21 and following? And here you'll find, if you check commentaries, there's a lot of disagreement. The critical school, that first category of approach we talked about, or have been talking about, would apply the entirety of the rest of the chapter to Antiochus, but then readily admit that not all of it can be harmonized with what we know of his reign and his time. That does not create a big problem for the critical commentators. They would explain that by saying the writer moves from recording history, he moves from history to prophecy, and he begins to speculate about what is in the future. And when he does that, he's wrong. So things didn't happen the way he thought they would. Look at your citations, page 47, under Norman Porteous, Daniel Commentary, Old Testament Library. He says, the longest, and from the point of view of the writer and his readers, much the most important section, verses 21 to 45, that's of chapter 11, is devoted to the reign of Antiochus Epiphanes. Against a vivid background of marching, counter-marching, of fighting, scheming, we get an impression of the strange, enigmatic character of this man, whom so many of the Jews hailed as representative of a culture in which they were eager to share, but whom the pious regarded as the archenemy of their ancestral faith. A glimpse is given of the Roman galleys, bringing the representative of the power which was to set a limit to Antiochus's ambitions and provoke him in reaction to his disappointment to his worst excesses against the faithful in Judea. That's verse 30. The ships of Catine shall come against him. I think I referred to that earlier. The Romans. The agony of those who suffered from the persecution is well suggested, and likewise the horror of the pious at the blasphemy of the persecutor and at the many who shared his guilt by their apostasy. And then notice the next phrase. And so, the writer passes from history to prophecy and forecasts a dramatic end for the tyrant, which, though it actually took place at about the time expected, falsified the prophecy as regards both its place and its manner. Now, when you get down to verse 40 and following, where you read, at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots, with horsemen, with many ships. He shall enter into the countries, shall overflow and pass through. He shall enter also into the glorious land, holy land, and many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom, Moab, the chief of the children of Ammon. He shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. But he shall have power over the treasures of gold and of silver and over all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall be at his steps. But tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go forth with great fury to destroy and utterly sweep away many. He shall plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas in the glorious holy mountain. Yet he shall come to his end, and none shall help him. When you read verses 40 down to 45, doesn't seem any way to harmonize that with anything in the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. So the next paragraph there, out of Porteous, which is speaking of this section of chapter 11, he says, attempts to reconcile this passage in Daniel with the well-attested facts of history are a waste of time. The critic, however, is grateful. Notice that. For this only in part fulfilled prophecy of Antiochus' death, inasmuch as it has made possible the accurate dating of the book of Daniel. Now you see the way the reasoning goes. It must have been written shortly before the death of Antiochus and the rededication of the temple by Judas Maccabeus, 164, 165, 164. In other words, You see, when he moves from history to prophecy, and the prophecy is wrong, assuming that he's still talking about Antiochus, that enables the critical scholar to say, right at that point, that it was written. So it was written shortly before the death of Antiochus. Because from that point on, it doesn't harmonize with what we know of Antiochus. Now, among those who would accept the authenticity of the book and its authorship by Daniel, there's difference of view on how to take verses 21 through the end of the chapter. I think all evangelical commentators would agree that there's more than simply Antiochus being described, and that in some way we move from Antiochus to the Antichrist, and that the Antichrist comes in view toward the end of chapter 11. Now, that's done in different ways. Some see 21 to 35 as referring to Antichrist. Excuse me, as referring to Antiochus. 21 to 35. And then, beginning with verse 36, you move from Antichrist, from Antiochus to Antichrist. So that there, the idea would be there's a time gap between 35 and 36. And you're speaking of Antiochus, and 21 to 35 fits well with Antiochus. It's when you get to the latter part of the chapter that it becomes more difficult. So I'd say that's probably the most common view, that there's a gap there between 35 and 36. J. Barton Payne puts the gap between 39 and 40, and begins at 40 with the phrase, "At the time of the end shall the king of the south," and that may be a reasonable breaking point, although generally it's placed between 35 and 36. Now, others do something else. Others suggest you have double reference, you see. You get back into that dual fulfillment sort of idea. Jerome says that beginning with verse 21 already, the things prophesied concern Antichrist. But since there are many things that fit Antiochus, he should be regarded as a type of Antichrist, and those things which partly apply to him completely are fulfilled in Antichrist. That gets very confusing, at least to me it does. But it's a version of double reference beginning at 21, so you have both Antichrist and Antiochus beginning at 21. Young follows Jerome to an extent, but with a qualification. Look at page 48 of your citations. Young says, "We, however, think that all these things are prophesied concerning Antichrist, who will come at the last time. And since to this there might seem to be opposed the fact that the prophetic word leaves such things in the middle, from Seleucus to the end of the world, it may be replied that in earlier history, where it was speaking about the kings of Persia, it put only four kings after Cyrus the Persian, and passing over many intervening events, suddenly came to Alexander, the Macedonian king. This is the custom of sacred scripture, not to relate everything, but to explain those things which seem to be most important. And since there are many things, which we must later read and expound, which do fit the person of Antiochus, he should be regarded as a type of the Antichrist. And those things which have partly applied to him as being completely fulfilled in the Antichrist." But he feels that, if you read where that paragraph is from in his commentary, he feels that really begins at verse 36, where you have things partly fulfilled in Antiochus, completely fulfilled in Antichrist, beginning at verse 36. Now, it seems to me in Young's discussion of verse 36 and following, he points out that all the information doesn't fit Antiochus and thus must have reference to the Antichrist, but he doesn't seem to me ever to come to grips with this problem of a time gap. Kind of fuses the two. I think it's clear that there's no way to avoid a gap in Daniel the time gap in Daniel 11. And I think you have to look at it this way. Either you place a gap between 20 and 21, and you move from the time of the Greek kingdom and its division into the Seleucid Ptolemy subdivisions. You move from that time to Antichrist, you see, and in his estate shall stand up a vile person, and you move from the Greek period to the end time, or you put a gap between 35 and 36, or 39 and 40, and you move from the time of Antiochus to the time of Antichrist, usually put between 35 and 36, but some between 39 and 40. Or, if 21 all the way through the end of the chapter is taken as referring to Antiochus, you still are faced, you see, chapter 11 flows on into chapter 12. 45 says, whoever it's speaking of, he shall plant the tabernacle of his palace between the seas and the glorious mountain, yet shall he come to his end, none shall help him. And at that time, you see, it flows on into 12, shall Michael stand up, the great prince who standeth for the children of thy people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never was, since there was a nation, even to that same time. And at that time thy people shall be delivered, every one that shall be found written in the book. And many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, some to shame and everlasting contempt. And they that be wise shall shine like the brightness of the firmament. They that turn many to righteousness as the stars forever and ever. If you say verse 21 of chapter 11 is referring to Antiochus, you move from the time of Antiochus in chapter 11 to the time of the resurrection in 12:2. So you still must place a gap then between 12:1 and 12:2. Certainly its time of Antiochus doesn't connect with the time of the resurrection, yet that's end time. So it seems to me there's no way to avoid a gap. When you see the way chapter 11 moves from the time of Antiochus until the time of the resurrection. And when a good part of particularly verses 40 and following does not fit with Antiochus, it seems best to me to place the gap either between 35 and 36 or between 39 and 40. And so that then at least 40 down through verse 2 of chapter 12, where you have the resurrection, is end time. And we're talking about the Antichrist. Okay, question or comment on that? Not maybe we can go ahead to 6 and try to pull some of this together and then move on to Ezekiel in our next session. 6 is conclusion on Daniel. Let's go back and sort of review what we've done. We've noticed there are three basic categories of approach. And we've looked at the various chapters, particularly those that have prediction in them, to see how they've been treated by these three categories of approach. We first looked at chapter 8, the little horn of verse 9 in chapter 8. Seems clearly to refer to Antiochus Epiphanes. And what you have in chapter 8 is the rise and full of Antiochus with a general survey of history that leads up to his time. The focus of the chapter is on Antiochus in chapter 8. In chapter 2, we notice that the stone cut without hands smites the image on its feet, broke them to pieces. The question is whether that is reference to the first or second advent of Christ. If it's the second advent, then there must be a time gap posited within the time span of that fourth kingdom, the Roman kingdom. seems to me that the statements of the chapter itself fit best with the second advent. The stone strikes on the feet, which is the second phase of that fourth kingdom. The image is completely destroyed. The stone fills the earth. I think the question with chapter 2 is it not too artificial to posit a time gap? That's the question that gives hesitation towards a second advent view. When you get to chapter 7, with the four beasts representing the four kingdoms, and out of the fourth you have that little horn that comes up, I think it's quite clear that that is reference to Antichrist and his destruction at the second advent of Christ. It's interesting that Young agrees with that view, although he sees no time gap in the chapter because he sees those ten horns as the second phase of the fourth kingdom and a continuous history, but nevertheless, second advent. When you get to chapter 11 that we just looked at, you have a detailed picture of the history of the Seleucid-Ptolemaic relationships up to the time of Antiochus. But it seems at some point there's a transition to a description of Antichrist. And it seems to me most likely with verse 36 or else verse 40. I don't think there's any way to avoid a gap in Daniel 11. Because you move from Antiochus to the Antichrist. And you have to put that gap either between 20 and 21, 35 and 36, 39 and 40, or 12, 1 and 2. You have to place it somewhere. You have the resurrection described in 12, 2. Now, if you see that chapter 7... pictures the second advent of Christ. And if you see in chapter 11 that there must be a time gap somewhere in the chapter, it seems to me then that you have a reasonable basis for suggesting the possibility of a gap in chapter 2. So that stone that hits the feet and the toes can be the second advent of Christ with a gap between the legs and the feet. Particularly since the kingdom that ensues fills the whole earth. But that would mean that chapter 2 and 7 both stress the second advent of Christ. It allows for this parallel between the ten toes and the ten horns. Now, if you adopt that view up to that point, it seems to me that it's not totally arbitrary when you get to chapter 9. That's different than saying that there is such a gap in chapter 9. I just think it's difficult to deny the possibility of the gap and say, well, there's no basis for that. You're reading it into the chapter. It seems to me when you look at the context of 9 with chapter 2, 7, 11, that it's not as arbitrary as it might first seem. However, it seems to me with 9 that ultimately the decision must be based on the exegesis of the phrases of verses 24 to 27. And I think you have to struggle with, you know, the various phrases of 24 to 27. What are they talking about? And when you come to a conclusion on exactly what they have reference to, it seems to me that that is the basis on which you ought to rest your view. And I think there are strengths and weaknesses with the interpretations of both positions. You know, you can look at any number of things. You look at that first phrase of 27, he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week. Is that talking about the Antichrist? And you get into the question of the terminology used there. The normal word for cutting a covenant is not used. Is this establishing a covenant or is it confirming an already existing covenant? Well, I think you have to you know, you have to exegetically wrestle with a question like that. What's in view? You have to wrestle with what's the antecedent of the he in 27. Who is the he? Is it the Messiah? Does it go back to the early part of 26? Who's going to confirm the covenant? Or is it this prince that shall come? Which is the antecedent? It's not an easy question to answer. There are strengths and weaknesses with both sides. As was pointed out by the First Advent group in our discussion, it is not necessarily inconsistent with the premillennial view of eschatology to find Daniel 9:24-27 to speak about things that will happen, for the most part, surrounding the First Advent of Christ and shortly thereafter. It seems to me with Daniel 9 we should be very careful about dogmatism in interpretation and be very careful about insisting on a view that is not completely clear or something that's built on inference. And it was all, as was also suggested, I think we should be very careful not to build an eschatological system based on a text that's legitimately open to alternate interpretations. Daniel 9 has often been almost a cornerstone in certain structures of eschatology. And I'm not sure that's the kind of passage that lends itself well to that sort of a function. You have to be very careful with 9:24-27. As I mentioned before, I think with 9:24-27, the question of when is the end of the 70th week is a difficulty for the First Advent view. I think the parallel in other texts, particularly in Revelation, of the middle of the week references, the 42 months, the 1260 days, and so forth, is something that fits well with the Second Advent view. So that's another one of those chronological things that at least has to be considered. But with the Second Advent view, I think that phrase, people of the prince, separating it to the armies of Titus and the Antichrist, is very awkward, to say the least, if not forced, as far as saying the one reference is the time of Titus. That's the people. But the genitive of the phrase is Antichrist. So there are difficulties. It's a passage that no matter how you go with it, you find problems. All right, questions or comments? It's 10-0. Yeah.
Which way do you move?
You know, on Daniel 9:24-27, I've been back and forth on that in my own mind. I think right now I lean more towards the First Advent interpretation. I certainly wouldn't be dogmatic about it. With the others, I would feel Second Advent with 2, Second Advent with 7. There seems to me clearly a gap in 11. I don't think you can avoid it. You move from Antichrist, from Antiochus to Antichrist into the resurrection. 8 seems to me to be Antiochus. So, to me, 9, I don't think to posit the time gap is arbitrary because it seems clear there's a gap in 11, probably a gap in 2. You can say, why not a gap in 9? And there's strengths and weaknesses, and you see on Interpretation 9. It's a hard passage, I think.
For
the non-gap view, the end of that 70th week, and the chronology of that. Yeah.
I'm just kind of wondering, what chance did the Jews have when they had the book of Daniel to understand like, what the prophecy is? I mean, we struggle now, and that's with a great deal of hindsight. You know, we have a lot of examples of scripture, prophetic foreshadowing. You know, they look at the coming of Christ and compress the two events, and, you know, no wonder they missed the Messiah. They were looking for...
Yeah, but I think I think, you know, no matter which view you have on this, the prophecy moves from the time of the captivity up to the first advent of Christ. Both views agree with on that. How you view, you know, putting an end to sacrifice, is that Christ putting an end to sacrifice, or is that Antichrist putting an end to some re-established system of sacrifice? We don't have clarity on that. I'm not sure the Jewish people would have clarity on that. But I think they could have seen the prophecy of the coming of the Messiah. Messiah has mentioned it. The term is used. I think more clearly than that, they certainly could have anticipated the persecution under Antiochus and known that this was within God's purposes for them and that there would be a deliverance from it. Remember, these are people in exile long before the time of the rise of the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. And certainly there was some great comfort to the Jewish people several centuries later, who actually underwent that time of persecution, to realize that it would be a deliverance from. So, and then in the larger function of prophecy, I think you do see in Antiochus an anticipation of the Antichrist in a typological sense, chapter 8. Now we discussed that issue. So, I think that there's a lot in it that calls God's people to obedience and faithfulness, even in the midst of times of persecution, because they can know that God is the ruler of history. And he's greater than all these human beings, whether it be Nebuchadnezzar or the Greek kings or Antiochus or whoever. And that, you know, Daniel said in that fiery furnace situation, God can, if he wills, deliver us, but if not, we're not going to obey you, because God is supreme, he is powerful. And so there's a lot to be learned from those prophecies, apart from some specific sort of time scheme as to pinpoint the date of something like that. We're over time. We'll move on to Ezekiel for our last three sessions.